This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Is Al Gore tossing his hat into the ring? This is a really interesting question and posed in a very interesting context. Well, a lot going on in our program today, by the way. I want to get into some of the economic things that are going on in the world. Oil has hit a new high. Gold is hitting new highs. The dollar is hitting new lows. A lot of people quite concerned about this, what's going on with this. In the midst of this, we've got folks on the right who are saying, oh, you know, we should give even more power to corporations. Let's not even have anti-monopoly laws or antitrust laws. That'll be our debate in the second hour of our program with Alex Epstein. In our third hour, David Harvey is here. He's the author of a brilliant book, A Brief History of Neoliberalism. It's my independent thinker of the month, book of the month for BuzzFlash.com this month. And we will be talking with David Harvey, and I think you're going to find that absolutely fascinating. So, to begin at the beginning with Al Gore. Al Gore rolled out this website some time back, and first of all, a tip of the hat to Admiral Loinpresser over at Democratic Underground, who first brought this to my attention, and I just, you know, with a great post over there at democraticunderground.com, and he pointed out that. Current.com, Al Gore rolled out this, what would you call it, TV channel? And
they were added 2 days ago.
And on this TV channel, Current.com, it used to be Current.tv when he first rolled it out, you can generate your own content and just put it up there. And back in March of last year, Ezra Klein wrote a great piece for the American Prospect. It's called The New Al Gore. Now, this is, keep in mind, this is 2 years ago. And he resurrected a word that had kind of died with the dot-com boom called disintermediation. And disintermediation was one of those, you know, like synergy, one of those terms that became so overused it was a cliche within a few months, but and was unique to the dot-coms. But what it means, basically, is cutting out the intermediates, cutting out the middlemen. You know, the classic case in the dot-com industry of disintermediation was Dell Computers. They manufactured the computers and sold them directly to the customers. And Gore was talking about, you know, a variation on this back in 2003 in a speech that he gave on August 7, 2003 at New York University. Klein points out that this was his first example of this. It was his first major speech after his concession address. And he says it was visionary, but what was visionary about it wasn't what he said, it was how he did it. He gave the speech, had it videotaped, handed it off to MoveOn.org, and they zapped out either the speech or a link to it. I don't remember which, and Klein doesn't specify. To their 3 or more million members. Wes Boyd, the founder of MoveOn.org, says, I know the word fell out of favor after the dot-com collapse, but what he's doing is disintermediation. He contacted us in the summer of 2003, said he wanted to give a speech, and was wondering if we'd like to sponsor it, and what we tended to is some of that disintermediation. End of quote from Wes Boyd, the co-founder of MoveOn.org. And so Al Gore, on his own, so then Gore rolls out this TV channel, Current.tv, and the right wingers are all making fun of him for it, you know, and it hasn't gotten a lot of play in the press. It's been largely ignored in the mainstream media, in fact. And one of the things that Gore has been pointing out, has been ripping into, is the mainstream media for ignoring things that are of consequence. So 2 days ago, Al Gore put up a couple of videos on his own website on current.com. And you go over to current.com and just, you know, type Al Gore into the search engine. I mean, this, he's not even waving the flag. It's not like he's saying, hey, this is my blog. It's not even on the homepage right now. But they're there. And it's just Al Gore sitting in a room looking at a camera. But what's interesting is these were put up right after he won the Nobel Prize, and they have nothing to do with global warming or the Nobel Prize. Instead, they have something to do with, they have to do with something quite different, which is the topics that real progressives and true classic Roosevelt Democrats and Greens are talking about in this campaign cycle. I started to call it this election year. The election year doesn't begin until January, but in this election cycle, in this election period. For example, our healthcare system. Here's Al Gore from his own site, current.com or current.tv, talking about healthcare.
I strongly support universal, single-payer, government-provided or government-funded healthcare. It doesn't mean that the government runs it, can have competition among the different providers, but I just think that we've long since reached the stage that it's immoral to put people in a situation where they cannot get the medical care they need.
Now, I'm going to pause him for just a second here. Did you hear how profound that is? I mean, the only, to the best of my knowledge, the only candidate on the Democratic side who's actually saying this right now, let's just do away with the health insurance companies and go to a single-payer system, period, right now, tomorrow, like they have in France. Let's just do it, is Dennis Kucinich. And here's Al Gore saying this, and he continues.
Because their incomes aren't high enough. I think it ought to be a matter of right. And our current system just doesn't work. It's way too expensive. The quality of health care is excellent for those who have enough money to buy the very best. But lower-income and low-middle-income Americans are not getting good health care, and so many now can't afford the private health insurance that they're going without insurance to millions and millions of people. And I think that to eliminate the incredibly ridiculous cost of all this unnecessary paperwork and different standards from different insurance companies, it is time to have universal health insurance.
Yeah, so that was one of three I'm going to share with you here this morning. Or this afternoon, depending on where you are in the country. And it raises the question, has Al Gore launched the first 21st century campaign for president? Is it like the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine? Remember, the Ukraine, Belarus, Soviet Georgia, Serbia, in all four of these countries, there were attempts to overthrow the current regimes. In three of the four, they were successful. These attempts were funded in part, actually, by the Republican and Democratic parties of the United States and by Freedom House, an organization founded by Eleanor Roosevelt. And in each one of these four countries, the media was controlled by the government or was controlled by oligarchs, by large corporate interests or wealthy families who were in bed with the government. And so you couldn't use the mainstream media. So the politicians, the people who in three of these four countries successfully took over the government through the electoral process, successfully won the elections, did it by using things other than the mainstream media, primarily the Internet. Is Al Gore doing the same? Or is he not running for president, but has he decided to use this extraordinary platform that he has of being the Nelson Mandela of the United States, or a Nelson Mandela? Jimmy Carter also won the Nobel Peace Prize, and other Americans have. Is he using that platform to say, I've got something to say, and it's important stuff, and it has to do with the issues of our day, and perhaps now people will pay attention to it? Is he trying to move the Democratic Party? Is he trying to move the folks who are running for president on the Democratic side in a direction that the crazies in the mainstream media would refer to as more left? And certainly the right-wing media, the Fox News bloviators and the hate radio guys, they would all call this, you know, leftist extremist stuff to call for a national health care program. And yet, every industrialized country in the world has it, and they don't consider it socialist or left-wing or anything like that. They consider it rational normal. And in fact, if you ask most Americans, would you like to have a system where everybody is covered? There's no more health insurance companies, no forms to fill out. You don't have to do all this song and dance to, you know, make sure that even your doctor gets paid. Would you like to have? Sure. The majority of Americans. Sure. This is not a radical position. So has Al Gore launched the first 21st century campaign for president, like the Orange Revolution in Ukraine? Or is he using this new platform to try to significantly affect the political discourse in the United States? In either case, I tip my hat to him. I'm going to share with you his other two postings to current.com right after this. Stick around, 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Yeah, Republicans, you're going down. And so are a lot of conservative Democrats, I have a feeling. America is waking up. America is saying enough already. And now there's actually political leaders, major, serious, mainstream, ran for president of the United States and got more votes than the other guy. And had the Supreme Court not intervened, would have become president of the United States. The only president of the United States who never served as president of the United States, Albert Gore, coming out and speaking out now, just in the last 2 days. Not about global warming, but about the issues facing America. Here's Al Gore on what we were yesterday. We had, you know, a long discussion, at some length anyway, about the FISA law and about the spying on Americans, and that apparently this even started before 9/11, and how complicit is the Bush administration in this, and frankly, how complicit is Congress in this for not exercising their oversight. Here's Al Gore on his own TV channel.
I think that we as Americans deserve more protection against the government being able to eavesdrop on our telephone conversations, on our email conversations, private conversations. And the Constitution has a requirement that the government get a warrant before it invades the private communications of people. And because of so much fear, especially since 9/11 and since the invasion of Iraq, the Congress has failed to exercise its responsibility to make sure that the executive branch is living up to what it's supposed to do under the Constitution. And I think that we need stricter laws to require that the government follow the requirements of the Constitution.
That's amazing. I mean, these are 60-second bits, basically. They run about 62 seconds each. And they are Al Gore, unscripted, unhandled, unmanaged. He's not even wearing a suit in these things. You see the TV of it. He's sitting there in an office with a shirt on. And he's just getting right to the issues. This is not about global warming. This is about the issues that are being debated, or certainly should be debated, because our debates have not been debates. We have not had one presidential debate yet. What we have had are opportunities to do cameo pieces. Serial cameos. Serial sound bites. And in fact, in some cases, the moderators even say, do it in 30 seconds. Now do it in 10 seconds. We should be having debates, but in any case, this is Al Gore talking about the real issues. Here's Al Gore on the war in Iraq, speaking the truth.
Everybody's talking about the war in Iraq, and most everybody agrees now that it was a big mistake to invade Iraq because they didn't have anything to do with attacking us on 9/11. But the question of how we get out of Iraq and under what circumstances is significantly more difficult. My own view is that we ought to withdraw as quickly as possible while keeping an eye on the obligation we have not to make an already terrible situation even worse in the manner of our leaving. But the longer we stay, the more we appear to be a magnet for the kind of violence that is feeding the civil war that has emerged inside Iraq. So I do think that our primary goal should be to get our troops home as quickly as possible.
Bingo. I mean, here is a guy, finally, a politician who's just speaking the truth, who's just saying it plain and every politician out there, or virtually every politician, as I said, Dennis Kucinich has said right straight up, you know, national health care, boom, do away with health insurance companies. John Edwards has said, allow people to buy into Medicare, which will put the health insurance companies out of business in a year or two, which is effectively the same thing. And that's a damn brave thing to say. And frankly, I think it's one of the reasons why the mainstream media is ignoring him as well. He's also talked about, you know, busting up big companies and looking at media and things like that. So, of course, he's not the friend of the mainstream media. But Al Gore just coming right out and saying, it's time for a single-payer healthcare system. You know what that means? That means an entire industry vanishing overnight. Now people go, oh, what about all those people? Where are their jobs going to go? I guarantee you, when all of a sudden America is unencumbered by the costs of healthcare and the huge CEO salaries associated with the health insurance industry, there is going to be an economic boom that's going to create a zillion jobs. And, you know, plus some reasonable recalibration of our trade policies. I'd love to hear Al's thoughts on that. I just find this fascinating. Is Al Gore, has he just fired the first shot in a new kind of presidential campaign? 26 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
One man come here to justify. One man to overthrow.
In the name of love. Yeah, in the name of democracy. I mean, it's amazing what's going on in the world today here. The New York Times reporting President Vladimir Putin of Russia arrived in Tehran today. Tehran, Iran. Tehran, Iran is now is the host today to Vlad Putin, the president of Russia. And he says he's going to use dialogue to try to resolve the international debate on Iran's nuclear program. And he said there will not be. He said we should not even think of making use of force in this region. He's calling out Cheney. He's saying don't even think about it. And we got nukes. I have a feeling that George W. Bush he has been so, he looked into his eyes and he saw his soul. He has been so outmaneuvered by this guy. If ever there was a time on the world stage when the United States needed strong, competent, honest, no BS, no unmanaged, by unmanaged, I mean not super handled by Bob Shrum and the DLC, leadership representing the will of the majority of the people of the United States, who the majority of the people want us out of the war. They want national health care. They want the executive branch. They want government to back down from all their snooping, particularly if they're spying on Democrats. I mean, here we've got General Abizaid coming out saying about the war in Iraq. Of course it's all about oil. We can't really deny that. We've treated the Arab world as a collection of big gas stations. Our message to them is, guys, keep your pumps open. Prices low. Be nice to the Israelis. You can do whatever you want. Out back. Osama and 9/11 is the distilled essence that represents everything going on out back. This is John Abizaid. Is the former? I mean, this was the guy, the commander of Central Command of CENTCOM. He's retired now. Meanwhile, oil is hitting like $87 a barrel. Was it $7 or $87? $88? $88 a barrel. Gold is spiking off the chart. And Turkey has massed 60,000 troops on the Kurdish border, and they're talking about invading Kurdistan at the same time that the U.S. Congress is slapping Turkey in the face diplomatically. And Al Gore comes out and says,
I strongly support universal, single-payer, government-provided or government-funded health care. It doesn't mean that the government runs it.
There we go. Just speaking the truth. Amazing. Let's see here. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Len in New York City. Hey, Len, welcome to the program.
Hi again, Tom. You know, I've been listening to Gore speak for the last number of years, and I saw him on TV about a year ago or so. There is Al Gore, the fearless spokesman and teller of truth, and then there is Al Gore, the politician. And, you know, there are many times you could see him transform from one back to the other. And if he decides that he's only going to be the one, you know, teller of truth, and put the politician's concern about how he phrases things aside, he would win in a minute. But he's got to decide that he's only going to be one Al Gore.
Yeah. Well, by putting it on current.tv or current.com, it seems to me that he has done that. I would say that, and Len, thanks for the call. I would say that he has now, he's on record. I mean, here it is. It's not possible for a candidate to back away from something like that. I mean, that's just, here it is, guys. One of two things is happening. Either he's trying to influence the debate, in which case, God bless him. It needs it. It really needs it. Or this is a stealth campaign. Chris sends me a note. He says, Al Gore is running, and he's running a stealthy revolutionary campaign that's bypassing the mainstream media. He's running a shadow campaign. It's stunning to watch. He says he is shifting the paradigm, and we're witnessing the same type of revolution that occurred when campaigns went from being print-oriented to radio to TV. This would be like the paradigm shift that happened when Roosevelt began his fireside chats. That was an amazing transformation of American politics. Radio came on the scene in the 20s and 30s and completely changed the American political scene. And then the Kennedy-Nixon debates in the 60s, as TV was making its way into every home in America, completely radicalized and transformed the way that political campaigns are conducted. Is Al Gore changing the way campaigns are being conducted in the United States now? Aaron in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, how you doing? Great show. Yeah, I've been watching that current TV probably almost 2 years, I think, now. I get so much information from that TV station. And anybody can send a pod in for about anything. It's great.
And you get this actually on your TV set? Because I've got, what is it, Verizon or Comcast or something. I've got Comcast cable, and I'm pretty sure it's not on there. Is it on one of the satellites?
DirecTV, and it's on 366, and I think that's a universal station. There's another, I don't know if you heard of Link TV. It's on 375.
Yeah, I've been on Link TV a couple of times, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the same kind of thing. You can't send in your own pods or whatever.
Now that Comcast is talking about taking MSNBC and making it a pay-for channel, I'm seriously thinking about dropping cable and going to DirecTV, to satellite TV anyway. So,
yeah, it's a better choice anyway.
Yeah, interesting. So you like current TV? You think Al Gore is running for president? Have you been seeing him a lot on it?
I've actually never. That's the thing. If these right wingers are trying to, if they ever say that he's just trying to use his TV station to boost his ego or whatever, for two years I've never seen him on the TV station, so you know, he keeps out of it. He just stays in the background. This is the first time I've ever seen him even or heard him using the station,
interesting.
It's great.
It would be a great thing. Aaron, thanks for the call. Al in Jersey City, New Jersey. Hey, Al.
Hey, how are you? Just a couple of things. Number one, I've got a re-elect Gore sign on my front lawn.
Ha-ha! Where'd you get it?
I made it. I had a sign maker do it. Hopefully he'll get a lot more orders.
Yeah.
And the other thing I want to say was, you know, when you've heard his Martin Luther King Day speech, where he has that fire in the belly?
Yeah, I played part of it last week.
Right. And some of those speeches is that attitude and tone, I think, is really what everyone's looking for. Not the more calm, if you know what I'm getting at.
Well, I think we need both. We need somebody who is willing to speak with moral outrage and moral indignation when it's called for, and somebody who can sit down rationally and say, okay, and here's what we're going to do, guys. And this is a time both for moral outrage and for rational discourse. And so far, Al Gore, thank you, Al. Al Gore is modeling that very, very well. And whether he's doing it to try to influence political dialogue in the United States or whether he's doing it because he's running for president, either one is fine with me. Either one is just fine with me, as long as he's as effective as possible, which is why I'm highlighting this right now. I think that this is really worth highlighting. Chris in Dublin, California. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tom. This is a little off the Al Gore subject, but something I want to tell you, I want to disagree with you with. Regarding John Edwards, I know you endorsed him.
I have not endorsed John
Edwards. I mean, I know you favor him.
I, as far as I can go, is saying that of all the candidates, the candidate with whom I agree on most of the issues is Dennis Kucinich, and the candidate who I've sent money to is John Edwards.
Okay. Can you, if you ever get John Edwards on your show, can you do me a favor?
He's been on the show.
If you get him back on, him or Biden or Clinton or Obama, any of them, if you ever get one of them on, can you ask them on the air why in that debate in April when Brian Williams asked a show of hands which of them would support Dennis Kucinich's resolution to impeach Cheney, why not one of them would raise their hand? They're asking us to give them the opportunity to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. They had a chance right there to show unequivocally how they would do it, and one of them, not even Gravel, not one of them would raise their hand.
It might have been because it was Kucinich's resolution. competitor. But
he's the only guy, aside from Gore, who's not really in the race, Dennis Kucinich is the only guy that I believe up there that says what he means and does what he says.
Yeah. Now, I don't disagree with you, Chris. I don't disagree with you at all. Dennis Kucinich is a good guy. And I have a lot of respect for him. And I, as I said, I agree with him on all the issues. And I think that John Edwards would make a great president. We'll see. I mean, whoever the Democratic nominee is, in all probability, I will support in the hopes that enough of us can participate in the process and get out there and make things happen, that we can change it. Angela in Somerville, South Carolina. Angela, we've got just about a half a minute here before we've got to take a break. Is it a quick one?
Yeah. There are people in this state and other states that are trying to go on the ballot in their states. Mm-hmm. We're the third primary state. If they go to algore.org, they can find out about how to join this movement in their own state, algore.org.
Okay, great. Angela, thank you very much for the heads up. It's much appreciated. Algore.org and learn all about it. Angela, thanks for the call. 866-303-2270, our telephone number if you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com. Live chat is the link right up at the top of the page. And our blog over at airamerica.com. And register your thoughts, opinions, considerations, whatever it may be. Is Al Gore running for president? Should he run for president? 45 minutes past the hour. Maybe he's not waiting at all. Maybe what we're seeing is a 21st century campaign for president. Or maybe we're seeing a brilliant attempt to influence the campaign of 2008 and the candidates. In either case, it's something we all should be paying attention to. Al Gore doing a great job over Current TV. Donna in Detroit, Michigan. Thanks for calling, Donna. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I like your show a great deal. Listen, Al Gore is the right man. The time is right. It's not too late for him to jump into the race. Here's what I've not understood during this whole, the last 2 years, including 2006, the absolute wimping out of Democrats to start chasing after these bullet points that the right wing game machine keeps throwing out there point for point. Why aren't we throwing it right back? I mean, they say, well, we don't want to go home to a 5-second commercial that says, oh, they're soft on terrorism and, you know, they're tax and spend. And Al Gore is the guy to say, no, we're not, and here's why. And this is what the American people want. This is what the American people demand. You know, that's nonsense. This is not the way to solve the terrorism. It's not fought with guns and with the war machine and the industrial military complex. It's fought with intelligence and diplomacy and patience and exchange of...
And winning hearts and minds. One of the reasons that Hamas has been so successful and Hezbollah have been so successful in the West Bank and in Lebanon is because they open hospitals, they feed people, they open schools. I mean, you have to win people's hearts and minds. You know, if terrorists can win people's hearts and minds, if people whose many of whose standards we would be horrified by can win people's hearts and minds, then certainly we can, and we have in the past. It's just that we're not going to do it by playing bully to the world and you know, going trash, invading countries and talking about crusades and trying to use military solutions for it. You're absolutely right, Donna.
We have to start fighting back, and I think he's the one that can do it point for point, because this is where America is really at. And, the right-wing scheme machine, the Reich, is going down, and Al's got the personality, and fortunately some have the idea out there and talk the talk and have the right policies in mind to put into place. But it's an unfortunate thing, but you need the right person and the right charismatic personality to be able to put it out there, to draw attention, to get the media to respond. And I think he's the person to do it, and now is the time. And I think he can answer it point by point. Somebody else brought up, you need somebody to either play politician or shoot from the hip and say it how it is. The American people are so ready for somebody to say, this is how it is, I'm shooting from the hip, this is the truth, this is where I'm at. It's sort of akin to the movie that Robin Williams played in. I mean,
you're absolutely right. Yeah, like Bullworth, you know. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Don, and thank you very much. You said it very well. It's what Teddy Roosevelt did. It's what Franklin Roosevelt did to a large extent. It's what John Kennedy did. It's certainly what Robert Kennedy was doing when he was running for president. It certainly is what Robert Kennedy was doing. Is speaking truth to power, calling him out, and running on a campaign of absolute unvarnished honesty. Sam in Hackensack, New Jersey. Hey, Sam.
Hi. The only politician in my life that I was ever, like, thrilled to vote for was Bill Clinton the first time. And I think everybody would feel that way about Al Gore now. I mean, the people voting for Hillary Clinton, I don't know, I'm guessing, like, half of them would rather vote for Al Gore. And not to make light of this, but and I hate to put that tag on people, but as a patriot, he should run right now. Country needs him. We need him. And never in my life has there been a time. It's pivotal.
And the important point to note, Sam, and I'd like to get your take on this. I voted for Bill Clinton that first time, too. Actually, I voted for Bill Clinton both times. But the reason why I voted for him was was because he was running a campaign as a progressive. And then we learned, and now we've just learned it in the last year or so, that within about 3 weeks of the time that he was inaugurated, after he had been elected, but before he actually took office in early January or late December, Alan Greenspan and Robert Rubin sat him down and said, we know you ran as a progressive and you were making all these promises and you were talking about this, that, and the other thing, but we're going to tell you how the world really works. And he governed as a moderate Republican rather than as the progressive that he ran as. And he brought us NAFTA and he brought us the Telecommunications Act, and he really screwed this country up in a big way, in a whole lot of ways. I mean, you know, he did some reasonable things, but his destruction of the welfare programs and things, I just don't, you know, I don't buy it. And I think it's a shame. I think it's just a tragedy. What we have seen is ever since Reagan was elected in 80, this steady destruction of the New Deal. And Clinton ran on a campaign in 92 of reversing that and then didn't govern that way. If Gore runs on that campaign, I believe that he will run that he would govern that way, and I believe John Edwards would as well, or Dennis Kucinich for that matter.
I just think the time is right for Al Gore. I don't think Al Gore will turn on us that way.
Yeah, I hope you are right, and I believe you're right actually, because he's been there, he's been through it, he's seen it. I mean, this just coming out, speaking out bluntly.
I strongly support universal, single payer, government provided or government funded health care. It doesn't mean that the government runs it.
And he just gets right out there and says it. As opposed to Fred Thompson, for example. Here's a clip from Fred Thompson's debate. Yeah, Fred. Yeah, you can see that over at YouTube as well. Coming up next, Alex Epstein. Should we break up monopolies and trusts? Stick around.
Truth. Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Okay, oil is $88 a barrel. Gold is $760? $760? Is that it? I'm forgetting my numbers. It has been all over the place. Where it's going, it peaked out at $765 today. We're seeing commodities explode, in part because there's concern that the world might be about to melt down, that Turkey maybe is going to invade Iraq, that the Middle East is in flames, that George Bush has brought the world to the brink of a war, that Vladimir Putin is in Iran saying, don't you dare shoot, take out the... And in part, because I would submit, because in 1980, starting in 1980, when the New Deal ended, or 81... When the New Deal began to end, and we came back to the era of the robber barons, as laissez-faire economics, conservative economics raised its ugly head again with Reaganism and trickle-down economics and all this sort of thing, the big companies started getting bigger. Reagan suspended the antitrust laws, the Sherman antitrust law, for all practical purposes. Jimmy Carter was the last president to seriously break up a company, broke up AT&T. Reagan suspended that, and we had this wild period of about 2, 3 years, 4 years. Well, actually, it was through most of his presidency, of the Michael Milkins of the world. Remember Michael Milken? The mergers and acquisition mania, the big getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's just been continuing. Are we going to end up with one company ruling the world, or one company in each industry ruling the world, or one company with multiple industries ruling the world? I mean, General Electric, major defense contractor, major media company. At what point do we say enough? Alex Epstein is with us. He's a junior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, the holders of the flame of objectivism, the philosophy that is that informs, let's say, the philosophy of libertarianism and conservatism and conservative philosophy, although it isn't. It informs it. Alex, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Well, it definitely does not inform it enough, because those philosophies have big, big problems. But I really thanks for having me, and I really appreciate you making most of my case against antitrust for me. Because you're absolutely right. The Reagan administration had many flaws, but one of its virtues was that it had much more lax enforcement of the antitrust laws than previous administrations. And that is a very overlooked factor for why there has been so much economic growth in technology and in other industries since then. So that's an indication of the broader destructive impact of antitrust laws and the constructive impact of lessening them or doing the right thing, which is to get rid of them. Because all these are laws that punish successful companies for being successful, for creating...
Okay, from 19... So let me get this straight. From 1940 to 1980, we had an average economic growth, average growth of GDP in the United States of just under 6%. From 1980 to 2005, we've had an average annual GDP growth of just over 3%. And you're saying that the post-Reagan era was better than the pre-Reagan era?
Yeah, so we'd have to look at the year-by-year breakdown, but notice you're taking this huge, huge swath of period.
That's because a giant switch was flipped in 1981. Reagan, no president since Reagan has gone back to enforcing antitrust law.
Well, first of all, there's a whole question of what it means to enforce antitrust, quote, laws, because they're not really laws. They prevent undefined things like, quote, restraint of trade or, quote, unfair competition. And the only real common denominator is that if you become really successful, you are regarded as a threat by these laws. But as far as those statistics, that's just a typical kind of distortion to take a 60-year period and then look at a 20-year period. So we'd have to look at those statistics, and unfortunately...
I'm taking a 60, 70-year period and just cutting it in half and saying, okay, there was a significant turning point in 1981, and if you average out ever since then, rather than just looking at GDP, if you look at average wages... Wages have been steadily declining since Reagan came into office, and they're continuing to decline in real dollars, whereas they had been steadily increasing from 1940 all the way up until 1980,
okay.
Actually up until 78.
I don't think that's true at all, but we'd have to break down the statistics. And
trust me, Alex, it is.
I don't trust you because I've seen the exact opposite. But to break down the impact of antitrust, we'd have to separate out all of these different variables. So let's just talk about the nature of antitrust and why you think it's necessary and why I say, in fact, it's completely unnecessary.
Okay, well, let me toss out two reasons why I think it's necessary, and I'd love to get your response.
Okay.
I remember before Reagan, there were a lot of small entrepreneurs, a lot of people starting small businesses. I was one of them. And you could look at any little strip mall or shopping center in America, or even a big strip mall or shopping center in America, before 1980, and the vast majority of the businesses in there were locally owned. They were locally owned restaurants, they were locally owned video stores, they were locally owned appliance stores, locally owned, you name it. It was the vast majority of America was locally owned. You could travel around this country and every city looked different because every city was locally owned. After 1980, after Reagan stopped enforcing the antitrust laws and big corporations got so big that basically nobody could compete against them, the economies of scale, they became so efficient, and I know you celebrate this, they became so efficient that any company that was even slightly less efficient got wiped out. We now have this homogeneity across the United States. Every shopping mall looks the same. Every city looks the same. And becoming an entrepreneur in America now is damn near impossible.
Wow. Well, okay. Very little of that is the case. But let's look at this issue of small entrepreneur. So there's an issue if you want to start a business in America, and I know some people regard it as unfortunate, but I regard it as a good thing. If you want to be an entrepreneur, if you want to have a business, you actually have to sell a product that customers value and that they value more than the things that other people produce. And a fact of life is that for many products, and certainly not for all products in all sectors, which is why we have so many small businesses, but for many products, by far the most efficient and good way to produce something is with a larger integrated organization with economies of scale. And if you look at the general situation, we all used to be independent entrepreneurs, as in subsistence farmers. And that was a really, really bad state of affairs. So one of the great pieces of evolution in an economic system is the division of labor, is specialization through the mechanism of large industrial enterprises that can have each individual do what he does best and coordinate to make each individual far more efficient and productive than he would be running his own little mom-and-pop store. Now, sometimes mom-and-pop stores are efficient, and those are the ones we frequent, and that's great.
So my wife's grandmother, for example, who just died a few years ago in her 90s and was lucid right up to the last minute, who had a family farm that Louise grew up on during the summers back in the 50s, she had that family farm throughout the Great Depression. If you look back from the period of roughly 1860 until the period of roughly 1940, the only middle class in America, for all practical purposes, was small family farmers. And, you know, Grandma didn't much notice the Great Depression. I mean, she bought one dress from Sears, and she bought salt and sugar. And that was it. You know, everything else, they pretty much grew on the farm and ate on the farm. And they had a very self-reliant life. And you're saying that's a bad thing, that instead Cargill should have been running everything and they should have been dependent on ADM for their food?
See, I don't think of it in terms of these collective shoulds. It's up to the individual. If they own a farm, they can stay on the farm as long as they like. As far as I'm concerned, I much prefer being a writer to being a farmer doing labor all day and to not being able to afford modern medicine, modern technology, cell phone, email, all kinds of relaxation and rest.
But there are people who are suggesting
the 90% farmer era.
No, I understand that, Alex. But there are people who are suggesting that what is being done right now by big industrial combines is the same thing that John Rockefeller did with oil back in the 1880s, and that is that he would so control the market that he could control the price. He would drive the price down, and in fact, there's evidence that Walmart has been doing this for the better part of 15, 20 years. They come into a community, selectively drive down prices to put businesses out of business, and then raise those prices back up again. John Rockefeller did the same thing. We're seeing the same thing with family farms all across the United States. This is the consequence of monopoly. How is that good?
In terms of the specifics of Walmart and Rockefeller, there are all kinds of little cases. I happen to know quite a lot about the Rockefeller situation, but you have to look at the general phenomenon that made Rockefeller so successful was that he was far more efficient than everyone else. And I could give you an hour-long lecture on all of the innovations that Rockefeller made that other people didn't. I'll just give you one, though. He was really the first person in American business history to use scientists in the way that modern corporations do. So it's no accident that his scientists figured out how to refine oil more efficiently than anyone else.
But he collaborated with railroads to refuse to ship the oil of his competitors, for example.
Right, but he got, in terms of the issue of railroad rebates, it was because he was the most efficient he could offer.
No, it was because he had the economic power. Right, exactly. And therefore,
being more efficient. That's right, how you get economic power, by being a good producer.
So you think it's a good thing?
Rockefeller was an American hero as far as oil production goes.
Okay. People can read all about it over at Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org. Alex Epstein. Alex, thanks for being with us.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Can't you read the writing on the wall, Mark? Calling your attention, please. You were sure of your job. It was a secure job. Now that job is going overseas. No, you cannot blame it on the wall, Mark. It's just one department store. America's competitors are calculating. Stuff from wall to wall, witness a phenomenon sad and strange. We need leaders who can see free trade isn't really free. Something has to turn around, something has to change. Can't you see the writing on the wall?
Yeah, something's got to change here. Since 1978, basically since Reagan came into office, $1,880,584,314,858 worth of corporations, American companies, have been sold not just to monopolies, but to foreign companies. We're selling off America. 14,833 companies. You can see it all over at economyandcrisis.org. Here's another story that's just emblematic of this. This from Reuters. Dateline Los Angeles, Whole Foods Market, Inc. There was all this concern about, if they buy wild oats, is that going to be an antitrust thing? And ultimately, of course, the Bush administration said, antitrust, what's that? Whole Foods Market, Inc. said on Tuesday it planned to close 9 of the stores it acquired in the purchase of wild oats markets and will relocate another 8 outlets. The organic and natural foods grocer said the 8 relocated stores will be moved to Whole Foods sites in development. Also on Tuesday, Whole Foods said it completed the sale of all 35 Henry's Farmers Markets and Sun Harvest Markets to a unit of grocer Smart and Final for $166 million, etc. And what happens? The company's shares were up 99 cents or 2% at $49.72 in trading. Over in Europe, they're not quite so friendly to this. Microsoft has lost an appeal for antitrust. The European Commission hit Microsoft with a record $497 million euro fine. That's about $690 million. The European court, this is from the BBC, of first instance, upheld the ruling that Microsoft had abused its dominant market position. A probe concluded in 2004 that Microsoft was guilty of freezing out rivals in server software and products such as media players. I'm assuming Microsoft is, I believe Microsoft is appealing this. And here in Richmond, Novell Inc., here in the United States, Novell Inc. is suing Microsoft on an antitrust basis. It's going to be before the Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Good luck. Good luck. This is the U.S., where it has been 27 years since an administration saw a big corporation that they didn't love and want to embrace. This is what happens when we just say, okay, we're going to turn control of our economy over to large transnational corporations and let them get as big as they want, let them get as powerful as they want, let them do anything they want, because it's the free market. There is no such thing as a free market. Markets are the creation of people. Markets are the creation, and when it's more than a small number of people, markets are the creation of institutions that people create that produce the ground rules for market. In other words, markets are the creation of government. Government says, yes, we will authorize you to do business, and we will give you certain benefits for doing business. We'll limit your liabilities in a particular number of ways. We'll give you a different tax code than average citizens. There are all these benefits that we're going to provide for you, and in exchange for that, we want you to conduct yourself in a way that is useful to society. But the cons would like us to forget about that last little bit and just say, oh, yeah. We're going to give you all these benefits. We're going to give you special tax breaks. We're going to give you special treatment. And do whatever you want. Just be sure to contribute to our campaigns. And so what do we see? We see the destruction of the middle class in America. We're seeing the big getting bigger and the small dying away. We're seeing the evisceration of small businesses. Small businesses create more jobs than large businesses ever do, because they're less efficient. At a certain point, efficiency isn't the highest value. At a certain point, the highest value has to be what's best for society. Is the economy here to serve we the people? In other words, did we say we are going to allow the corporate form to exist because it will benefit us? Or are we here to serve the corporate form? Are we serfs living in a kingdom and we're the property of the landlords? We're the property of the corporate owners? I mean, those are the two models out there. And when we look at the history of the United States, we've seen this back and forth and back and forth on that, where there have been times where we said, no, you know, the economy is here to serve us. And there have been times when we've said, no, no, we're here to serve the economy. And ever since Reagan came into office, it's been, we're here to serve the economy. And that's what we've been getting, is the economy, in quotes, it's getting larger and stronger, the stock market going up, corporations get bigger and bigger, and the real wages of the middle class have been steadily declining. And now we're looking at the possibility with this housing bubble bursting of the whole thing falling in on itself. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Today you're working for the man.
Yeah, working for the man. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, a quick reminder to our friends listening on Talk 1090 in Seattle. I'll be up there on October 26th at 7:30 at the Elliott Bay Bookstore. And on the 27th, receiving a Project Censored Award. I am sharing the first prize in this year's Project Censored Award at Sonoma State University. So that should be a lot of fun, and they're both open events. Drop by and say hi. Our quote for the day, let's have some quotes for the day, some presidential quotes. Here's just to toss a few for this is from James Madison. There is an evil James Madison, the fourth president of the United States, the author of the Constitution. There is an evil with, which ought to be guarded against in the indefinite accumulation of property from the capacity of holding it in perpetuity by corporations. The power of all corporations ought to be limited in this respect. The growing wealth acquired by them never fails to be a source of abuses. Well, that's a good one. Or Thomas Jefferson, I hope we shall crush in its birth the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations, which dare already to challenge our government in a trial of strength and bid defiance to the laws of our country. Or Andrew Jackson, in this point, the case, the question is distinctly presented whether the people of the United States are to govern through representatives chosen by their unbiased suffrages, in other words, votes, or whether the money and power of a great corporation is to be secretly exerted to influence their judgment and control their decisions. President Andrew Jackson. How about President Andrew Martin Van Buren? I am more than ever convinced of the dangers to which the free and unbiased exercise of political opinion, the only sure foundation and safeguard of Republican government, would be exposed by any further increases of the already overgrown influence of corporate authorities. And then this final one from Grover Cleveland in the 1880s, the only Democrat who got elected during the Gilded Age there. Corporations, which should be the carefully restrained creatures of the law and the servants of the people, are fast becoming the people's masters. As we view the achievements of aggregated capital, we discover the existence of trust combinations and monopolies, while the citizen is struggling far in the rear or is trampled to death beneath an iron heel. Every single one, a president of the United States. Robert in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Robert.
Good morning. Hey, Tom, congratulations on the Project Censored Award.
Thank you.
There's a lot of fluffy accolades that go out in this industry, but that's one to really be proud of, and you should definitely publicize them as much as possible.
Okay, I will. I'm very proud of it, and we're going to have on Peter, I forget his last name, the guy who's running the Project Censored thing we'll be talking about on the radio. But that's not what you called about.
I have to refute your previous guest. I don't think that he represented free market capitalism at all. You know, John Kenneth Galbraith once wrote of, the Republican movement that emerged in the Reagan era, where everybody was citing free markets, saying he doubted any of them had actually read Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations. And your previous guest is probably a perfect example of that. The free market, what we have happening right now, and what's important to understand our current predicament, is that it's not a free market economy. It's basically cartel capitalism. Now, granted, the Republicans pay lots of lip service to free market ideology, but their policies really do support cartel capitalism.
Yeah, well, Alex is not a Republican, and he would argue that the Republicans, and for that matter even the Libertarians, have gone nowhere far enough, that we should take all government interference in the marketplace out, and the only role that the government should play in the marketplace is providing currency for it.
But I disagree. I don't think that's what Adam Smith's free market theory.
No, Adam Smith in Wealth of Nations was explicit that nations have an obligation to protect their own people and the competence of their own local economies.
Exactly. And, David Brock, in his two books, Blinded by the Right and the Republican Noise Machine, did a great job of exposing, basically the propaganda value of Reaganomics. And even though the authors of Reaganomics and trickle-down economics realized that it was bunk, that it was not a defensible academic theory.
Well, David Stockman, has since written, who is Reagan's, head economics guy, has since written a book apologizing for it.
Exactly.
Spot on.
It's important that people understand that and realize that we're getting into a cartel situation that's similar to what happened in Germany that gave Hitler the rise to power. And that's very well documented in Professor Carol Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope.
Although I think you could argue that the real thing that drove Hitler to power was the collapse of the German currency, which was largely the result of the Treaty of Versailles. And because the German economy was so just badly, totally trashed, people were like, somebody help us. And Hitler came along and said, yeah, I'll help you. And he did it with cartel capitalism, fascism, merging businesses and state interests and whatnot. But But, yeah. Anyhow, good point, Robert. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. John in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, John.
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Yes, of course you're going to get better. I've read Ayn Rand, and I think her point is lost on those who work at that institute. And Atlas Shrugged was also about the greed of those who control money and the ineptitude of the government, not just the free market. I work for a telecommunications manufacturer, and we build the infrastructure that makes the Internet work. And I joined that company in the early 90s. Several years ago, I went to a startup company that was going to put a competing product that was better, larger, faster, and put it out, and we did it. At the time, it was using a 40-gig chip, meaning it could move huge amounts of data. It had 480 gigabit interfaces. It could move nearly a half a terabit of data. The company I'm back at now conspired with the management of the ISPs and the telecom companies to kill that product and kill my company. The details of how they did this are incredible, and I wish I felt safe enough to go into them. But anyway, the assets of that company, of that startup, not the startup itself, were bought out by my current company, so I'm back where I started from. In some ways, I feel like a wage slave.
Well, that's the thing. I remember back, and I guess I'm labeling myself an old fart here, but I remember back in the 60s and 70s. I was a teenager in the 60s. You know, in the 70s, I was a young entrepreneur. And it's still, in this country at that time, there was still the idea that you would start a business, you would build it, you would live with it, you know, throughout your productive years, you would pass it along to your kids or to your employees. It would be part of the community. It would always be there. It was an entity that you created. Nowadays, I would say basically since the real damage of Reagan was done throughout the 80s, but it really became apparent in the 90s. So I'd say largely since the early 90s. Nowadays, young entrepreneurs or new entrepreneurs, even old entrepreneurs, are trying to start a business so that within a 1 to 2 year window, they can get it large enough that they can sell it to one of these giant corporations before that giant corporation notices them and steps on them like a bug.
But it's even worse because they've set back, they destroyed that technology 4 years ago, and now we're working on a system that's using technology that was first conceived in the 90s, and we're working on stuff that it's going to work, but it just isn't going to work as well as it could have. And
right, in other words, monopoly destroys innovation.
Monopoly destroys innovation, and the U.S. is losing its technology lead. We're about to become a second-rate country because of the greed exhibited by the members of the Bush crime family.
Okay, well said, John. And anybody who doesn't believe it, try using Microsoft Windows for a week. It's, yeah. 1-866-303-2270. And Luther in Yackel, Washington. Hey, Luther.
Hey, what's going on, Tom?
What are you calling about, Luther?
I was going to talk about your last guest.
Alex Epstein.
But somebody already took my... thunder. But I was saying that you mentioned that Hitler got his start from the collapsing currency, and it seems like our currency is starting to collapse right now. I wonder if there's any...
He used it. The collapsing currency provided the base. The economic collapse of the Weimar Republic provided the base. You know, it was the breeding ground for it. There was enormous discontent, massive unemployment, terrible economic problems. People were flipped out. They wanted somebody to blame. And Hitler came along and said, "Yeah, blame the communists, blame the Jews, blame the socialists, blame the trade unionists." And everybody said, "Yeah, cool, we'll do that." And off they were off to the races. And we've got people now in our country who are essentially, you know, saying the same thing. They've got a different bunch of, you know, let's blame them, you know, but...
It's a bloodthirsty religionist practiced over there by a bunch of throwbacks of where to kill them.
Ah, Michael Savage, shut up. You know, it's a back off. But, you know,
those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Yes. So anyhow, as I was saying, we have these...
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
We have these voices, and they're naughty voices.
Naughty boy.
Bad. Yes. Okay, Larry. Back in the closet. We have these voices out here who are saying that... Yeah, we've got enemies now, and we've got people to be afraid of, and they're those brown people coming from Mexico, or they're those brown people over in Iraq. You know, we are seeing, at a certain level, a repeat of that dance. That's the bad news. The good news is that most Americans now are hearing the call of people like Al Gore and saying, we're going to rise to our highest values, to our highest stance. We're going to reject the politics of division and hate, and we're going to move forward. We're going to create an economy that works for all and a nation that respects all. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
A little piece of me, a little piece of you, a little taste of something.
How about a little taste? How about a little taste of squirrel? Totally crazy stuff going on out here. A top restaurant, this is from the Daily Mail in the UK, a top restaurant is serving up free gray squirrel pancakes to hungry diners. Peking duck-style squirrel wraps are now being offered to diners at the famous Wild Boar Hotel near Windermere in Cumbria. I've been there. The gray squirrels were caught in the hotel's 72-acre woodland grounds and have been prepared by head chef Mark Sanders. Our diners seem to enjoy the squirrel pancakes. I thought they tasted rather nice, a bit like rabbit, he says. Oh, jeez. It's getting so weird. A couple of days ago, hey, Victoria Jones.
Hey.
A couple of days ago, Louise and I were walking down the street, and it was over in a park, actually, and there was, but we were walking on the part where the cars go, and there was a squirrel on the road. I thought it was dead. We walked over to it. He was still breathing. He must have just been hit. And I stood there for like 5 minutes with him while Louise went off to see if she could find a phone, you know, to call the DM, the parks folks, and say, we've got a squirrel here that needs some help. And I was like trying to send him good vibes, and I said a prayer for him, and I was like, you know, pointing my hand at him, trying to send it. And he woke up. And he got up, and he couldn't walk very well. He was just stunned, you know. So I picked him up and put him in the grass, and we stayed there with him for 10-15 minutes, and finally left. We meant to go back yesterday and make sure see what happened, but didn't. But anyhow, I can't imagine eating them. Yeah, I'm hoping that he was okay. I just can't, I can't get my head around eating them.
I can't get my head around that either. They're fluffy. You don't eat fluffy things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well.
That's, for me, there's a fluff meter when it comes to
food. There you go. So that's a good thing. Thank you for perfectly calibrating and framing that. What's going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, Washington is agog, and talking about the meeting of the Dalai Lama with President Bush, and the White House, of course, vigorously defending President Bush's plan to meet with the Dalai Lama today. And he's meeting with him privately in the private residence later today in the White House. So, of course, we don't know what's going to be said. And the Chinese are not agog. They are aghast. And, in fact, pulling out of a talk that they're supposed to be having with us on Iran on Wednesday. They're so ticked off about this. They've been working since last year to try and get this meeting scrapped and to get, of course, the medal that the Dalai Lama is getting scrapped because they do not want autonomy or independence for Tibet, where, of course, the Dalai Lama comes from. So this right. is a very, very big deal.
I think this will be a really good thing, frankly. I hopefully it'll even be a good thing for George Bush. I spent a week with the Dalai Lama at his home in Dharamsala and McLeod Ganj in India. I was one of 20-some-odd people. In fact, there's a movie about it that's playing right now called Dalai Lama Renaissance, with Harrison, narrated by Harrison Ford, about that week that we spent with him. And I was one of 20-some-odd people who had, in various disciplines, who had been selected to participate in this week-long dialogue. It was called the Synthesis Dialogues. And it was an amazing experience, first of all, and you know, sitting with him and talking with him for hours every day, and not just me, but as a group of us, and although I did it as well, and then going to his private residence on the very last day, and his saying, do you want to take refuge? Do you want to be an initiate? I guess would be a way to say it, and I did, many others did. So I guess I'm a Buddhist now, it was just extraordinary. The other thing that was extraordinary was Dharamsala. This is a town. It's a word that, in whatever the local language is, it literally means place of refuge. It's a town that was created out of nothing for the refugees from Tibet. And even while we were there, this was 6 or 7 years ago that I was there, even while we were there, there was, on a daily basis or on a regular basis, people arriving. They would come over the Himalayas from Tibet, fleeing. And there was one guy, I remember there was one guy who came, who and they would start out from Tibet with, you know, 10, 15, 20 people, a family, a couple of families. And by the time they got to Dharamsala, there would be five or six left because the bandits would kill them, the bears would eat them, the tigers would get them, they'd die of frostbite, they'd die of starvation, they'd get lost, they'd fall into crevasses. I mean, it's just a hellish journey. And this one guy came and the thing that caused his family to leave was that a member of their family had gotten a T-shirt in some care package or something with a picture of John Lennon on it, and the Chinese thought it was a picture of the Dalai Lama, and they had taken him and tortured him to death.
Whoa.
And you know, yeah, you know, one of the kids in this family. And every day from there's about 100,000 people living in Dharamsala, every single one of them had by foot made that journey over the Himalayas, and every single one of them had these god-awful, horrific stories to tell. And you know, I hope that some of that sinks into George W. Bush.
You've got to hope that something's going to sink into George W. Bush. But, you know, he is so certain of what he believes and of who he is. He doesn't ask questions. He doesn't ask questions of himself. He doesn't really ask questions of other people, it seems, even when he's having consultations with members of Congress or with other people. It seems that he knows what he wants to know. So maybe he's open to hearing something from the Dalai Lama, but it's, I think, questionable.
His Holiness has a presence that is startling, Victoria. It's just absolutely startling. And he has a way of summarizing things in very, he'll talk at length, but he can summarize things in a very, very pithy way that you just can't avoid. I can't help but hope that what's going to come out of this is something good for the United States and frankly, for George W. Bush, because he's a guy who's in need of healing and spiritual healing, and maybe this man can provide some to him. So, I don't know. We'll see.
You've got to hope.
Yeah. That's all we have. It seems some days, and, you know, hope dies last. We've got about a half a minute, Victoria. Anything else going on that we need to know about? Vlad Putin's in Tehran. That's a big deal.
It's definitely a very big deal. Here in Washington, the other big deal that's going on is everybody's just counting the money that's being given to the candidates. It seems that that's the only thing that's being talked about is how much does Hillary have, how much does Obama have, how much has Rudy spent, and how much has Romney spent. That's all anybody's talking about.
Well, Al Gore now has come out with three videos over the last 2 days on his website, current.tv or current.com, talking about health care, the war in Iraq, and domestic spying. He's sounding like a candidate on the Internet. Check it out.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Great talking with you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Circuit, Service, talkradionews.com. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Tune into the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. Oh, man. It is so fun to work with people who are bright and competent. And I am so, so blessed. David and Louise here at Portland and Chris and Lauren there in New York. We're having a great day. You're not hearing the whole thing, but we're having a great day. David Harvey is with us. David Harvey is the author of what I consider to be one of the most important and brilliant books that I have read in a long, long time. My criteria for how good a book is that it has to do with this unspeakable thing, speaking as an author, this unspeakable thing that I do to books that I find really, really useful, nonfiction books, is dog-earing pages and highlighting text. And I would say probably half the pages in this book are dog-eared, and maybe as much as a fifth of the text in this book has been highlighted. It's amazing. It's called A Brief History of Neoliberalism. It is our book of the month over at BuzzFlash.com. And if you want to support that website, you go over to BuzzFlash.com. You can read my review of the book. You can see the book. There's some excerpts of the book there. David Harvey, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You have chosen the word neoliberalism for the title, A Brief History of Neoliberalism. And I suspect that most Americans have no idea what that means. You want to give us a quick definition?
Well,
The interesting thing about that is most of the rest of the world knows what it means.
Yes, exactly.
But it's not widespread here because there's all this confusion about what liberalism means. But what neoliberalism really means is a deep attachment to the idea that everything should be done through the free market, that personal responsibility is everything, and the state should not take responsibility for anything very much. So it's about a privatized world and a free market system.
And your book, I recently also read Naomi Klein's book, Disaster Capitalism, or Shock Doctrine. Doctrine, where she talks about disaster capitalism. And her book, by story, describes essentially the exact same arc that your book describes in a very methodical, very straightforward, and extraordinarily detailed, nonfiction narrative. And there is an inevitable consequence that happens when countries undergo this transformation into neoliberalism, as happened with Thatcher in 79 in England, as happened in the United States in 1981 with Reagan. Tell us about that.
The most important thing is that the rich get incredibly richer. And if you take a country like Mexico, for example, which went through neoliberalism in the sort of late 1980s, early 1990s, they then ended up with 14 billionaires on the world's wealthiest list. And now the wealthiest person in the world is a Mexican called Carlos Slim. So that's what neoliberalism does. It allows people to get incredibly rich.
And the rest of us?
And the rest of us either don't get much movement at all, or else we actually lose out by what I call accumulation by dispossession. That is, somebody takes away our assets, our rights, and that money then sort of floats up to the top.
So to a certain extent, and you're suggesting an economy is a zero-sum game. That is to say, if somebody's getting richer, that means somebody else has to be getting poorer at a certain level.
Not all economies are zero-sum games. I mean, there was a time when there was real growth going on, and there's a bit of growth been going on, but it's been very low recently. So actually, most of the gains that have been made by the very rich have been at the expense of the poor.
Yeah, or the middle class.
Or the middle class.
Who are rapidly becoming the poor.
Who are incredibly becoming the poor, yes.
Yeah. And you tell the story in the book about how neoliberalism was brought to Chile, how it happened in the United States, how it happened in England. And it typically does not happen as a consequence of the people getting together and saying, gee, we'd like to do, like the great support that Roosevelt had, for example, for passing Social Security in 1936, or for the Wagner Act to legalize unions in 1935. It doesn't happen that way. It happens by a different mechanism.
Happens by kind of stealth in many ways. The corporations and the rich sponsor think tanks, which then start to spread all kinds of ideas around the economy, and they get hold of the press, they get hold of the media, so now increasingly the media controlled by a few press barons, and then of course they start to control the political process and the political parties by the amount of money they control. So it works that way. It's almost like a coup. I mean, there was a military coup in Chile. There was really a financial and corporate coup in this country.
Mm-hmm. And there's an intellectual coup.
And an intellectual coup because you increasingly control what is happening in universities by, for example, large donations to the research universities and the like.
Yeah, I was listening to I think it was Saturday morning. We were at one of our kids' house and listening to National Public Radio was on, and their international economics correspondent was being interviewed by the morning host, and was basically putting out this neoliberal line. The discussion was international free trade, which really is, free for corporations and not for anybody else. And he was saying, well, there's a few crackpots who are. And I'm not by any means quoting the guy, but this is the essence of his message. There are a few people on the fringe who are opposed to this, but and then the guy says, well, what argument do they make? And well, they make the argument that there should be protections for labor and the environment, but that's not always practical. And frankly, those aren't even the arguments that those of us who are really opposed to this make. I mean, I think somebody who's unionized in China with a decent environment making $3 an hour is still going to wipe out jobs in the U.S. at $18 or $20 an hour. They have nearly completely seized the mind space of America, or this largely happened in the 80s and 90s, would you not say?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the lines in the book, which I think strikes home with a lot of people, is when I kind of say, you know, we're all neoliberals now, often without realizing it, you know, because we've almost internalized this idea that we're personally responsible for everything that happens to us, but we're not really responsible for what happens to our neighbors or what happens in society in general. And we've all got like that, you know, because that's the way the society works these days.
It's the me society rather than the we society.
Absolutely.
We're thinking as individuals rather than, and this has been absolutely inculcated in us. You talk about how even Bill Clinton, who campaigned as a liberal, became a neoliberal.
Oh, yeah, well, it's great. He came in promising things like universal health care and so on, and what did he give us? He gave us NAFTA and the reform of the welfare system. He in many ways is a quintessential neoliberal.
Yeah, and what are you seeing on the horizon? Now, if we can step just a little beyond the book right now in our conversation, and I'm curious, David Harvey, we're talking about David Harvey, he's the author of A Brief History of Neoliberalism, which is my BuzzFlash book of the month this month over at BuzzFlash.com, and just a brilliant read. What do you see among the current crop of presidential candidates, and what's the gestalt in Congress overall in terms of neoliberalism? Do you see it starting to crumble, or do you see it gaining ground or strengthening?
I think it's in a bit of a crisis right now. We see things like what's going on in the mortgage market. We see the financial sector getting a bit unstable. There's worries also about insecurity and jobs and so on. So there's a lot of kind of nervousness about continuing with the neoliberal line. So indeed you do get little surges of saying, well, maybe protectionism is the answer, or maybe a little bit more state regulation is the answer. So there's beginning to be some very mild questions asked about how good this neoliberal kind of economic policy really is.
Right, here in the United States.
Yes.
There's
intense opposition in countries in Latin America. I mean, Bolivia or Venezuela or Argentina or even Brazil.
Well, the rest of the world looks at this and they see how neoliberalism was imposed in Argentina. In fact, I was down there back 10 years ago or so, right after the absolute disaster. In Chile, they look at the experiment with Thatcher in the UK. They see what happened with Reagan here in the US, and yet France seems to be moving in a neoliberal direction right now at the same time that Sweden is moving away from it.
Yes, this is part of the power of the corporations to influence government and, in a way, purchase elections.
And also influence public opinion.
And influence public opinion, yes.
Yeah. You have, sir, written an absolutely brilliant book, and I want to recommend it to every single one of my listeners. David Harvey is the author. The book is A Brief History of Neoliberalism. It's published by Oxford University Press, and if it's not in a bookstore near you, demand that they stock, you know, a dozen copies of it. And you can also check it out over at BuzzFlash.com, where it's our BuzzFlash Book of the Month. David Harvey, thanks so much for being with us.
All right, thank you.
Good speaking with you.
Good speaking with you. Thanks very much.
Keep up the great work. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Neoliberalism, or corporatism, or conservative economics, or Reaganomics, or Reaganism, or trickle-down economics, whatever you want to call it, it's all the same thing, and it is all sick and twisted, and it's destroying America, and we are, and many other countries. And it is, as David Harvey pointed out, creating billionaires. 114 billionaires now in China. As China becomes neoliberal, demonstrating that neoliberalism or conservative economics, or as I said, whatever you want to call it, has nothing to do with democracy. it exists very fine, thank you very much, with a dictator like Pinochet or a dictator like who? The Chinese guy, not the WHO. You know what I'm talking about. And here's the best example of it. Today's neoliberals. The problem with using that word is, as David Harvey pointed out, most Americans don't know what it means. Europeans, people all over the world know what that word means. We don't in this country. So let's call it conservatives, because that's how we would understand it. Reagan conservatives. They're out now attacking a two-year-old and her mom. Yep. A two-year-old and her mom. Bethany Wilkerson. She was born with a serious heart problem. The only way that she was able to stay alive is through insurance provided by the State Children's Health Insurance Program, the SCHIP program, that George Bush just vetoed. And like Graham Frost's family, who went out there and, you know, Graham Frost came out and said, hey, you know, I am alive. My sister's alive because the insurance provided by the SCHIP program. And then they went after his father and mother saying, oh, how dare they? This guy makes $45,000 a year. He can afford to spend, $10,000 a year for health insurance. Any dog food? So now we've got the right-wing slime machine with anchor baby Michelle Malkin. Her phrase, not mine. Saying, for Darren Breyer Wilkinson, the fact that they don't have health insurance is less about falling through the cracks than the decisions they've made. Yeah, right. Excuse me, that was National Review's Mark Hemingway who said that. Michelle Malkin's comment was, she writes, the Wilkersons have made a choice. And she says, we need more partisan bickering, not less. And then, you know, the follow-up from the National Review's Hemingway. Well, Dara Wilkerson, the mother of this two-year-old child who has survived because of the SCHIP program. See, they're attacking her. They're saying, this is what the right-wing National Review says. Dara voluntarily left a job at a country club that had good health insurance because the situation was unmanageable to take a job at a restaurant with no health insurance. Well, she replies, the mom. She says, we have seen the statement about my previous employment, and here's what we have to say. I left my previous place of employment before Bethany became part of our lives. I am a hardworking woman. I have worked at Snapper's Sea Grill for over 6 years. It is a good work environment, and I am a loyal employee. My husband and I were blessed with Bethany 2 years ago, and we are even more blessed to still have her with us today. But as these Reichwingers, by coincidence, these pro-lifers would have it, the Wilkersons should have either, apparently, maybe they're suggesting that they shouldn't have the child, that there should have been an abortion. Is that the suggestion? Is that what Michelle Malkin is saying? Or that we should have euthanasia by neglect? Oh, you don't have insurance. And your child has a heart defect, and it's going to cost a lot to fix. Well, she dies. That's the conservative way. You made a choice to take a job that doesn't have health insurance. Yeah, over 40 million Americans have made the choice to take jobs that don't have health insurance. And how many employers are making the choice? I mean, this is absolutely crazy. Al Gore has it so right.
I strongly support universal, single-payer, government-provided or government-funded health care. It doesn't mean that the government runs it, can have competition among the different providers, but I just think that we've long since reached the stage that it's immoral to put people in a situation where they cannot get the medical care they need.
And it is. And his saying that is a direct assault on what David Harvey refers to and the rest of the world refers to as neoliberalism and what we here in the United States refer to as Reagan conservative economics. And it's time for us to look back on the experiment that has been foisted upon us over the last 26 years and say, yes, it worked out very well for a few people. There's a few hundred billionaires who it's worked out very well for. And about 120,000 millionaires that it's worked out very well for. Excuse me, about 300,000 millionaires for whom it's worked out very well. And pretty much the rest of us got screwed. 27 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. Strange stuff going on out there in the world. It's getting weirder and weirder, crazier and crazier. Another one. Yeah, this is from Scranton, Pennsylvania, West Scranton. Poor Dawn Herb. In her own house. Her toilet's overflowing. She's yelling downstairs to her kid to get the mop, and she yells an obscenity. Her next-door neighbor, an off-duty police officer, happens to hear the obscenity that she shouts in her own house at her toilet and has her arrested for disorderly conduct. The next-door neighbor, Patrick Gilman, a city police officer, didn't like the language she was using. The citation accuses the defendant of using obscene language or gestures with intent to cause public inconvenience or annoyance or harm or recklessly create a risk. She says, there was no intent to do anything. I just feel so violated and irritated. I don't even have a criminal record. Amazing. Only in America. Ron in Vermont on the line. Hey, Ron, thanks for calling. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for being such a great historian. You've learned so much from history.
Well, thank you for listening, Ron. What's your question?
Neoliberalism. It sounds, you know, another name for fascism.
It's close.
Wouldn't it be nice to ask that question to the Republicans during their debate? You know, what is neoliberalism? But here's my. I just went on a trip to Ellis Island, and I just couldn't believe. You know, they have all these artifacts and they have articles posted, and every single argument that I hear today to keep, you know, Mexicans out or, you know, third world country people out are the exact same arguments written back then. It just blows me away.
Well, there have always been two currents of anti-immigrant is probably too broad a term, but there have always been two currents of anti-immigrant sentiment, not just in the United States, but in every country in the world. One has been the racist current. You know, those people are not like us. We don't want them here. And the other has been the I don't want to compete with them current. We don't want them taking our jobs. And there have been times in the United States where we openly embraced immigrants when we were, you know, aggressively stealing land from Native Americans, from Indians, and said, oh, yeah, more Europeans. We need more Europeans. Get them over here. And then there were times when, you know, as the robber barons basically took over and jobs were hard to get and labor was really cheap, there was a lot of sentiment against immigration. I mean, in the 1880s, when the railroads, when the progressive movement started and the railroads were faced with the earliest of the union movements, the Wobblies and whatnot, and the Pullman strike, the railroads started importing labor from China. Bringing Chinese in specifically to break the strikes. And so you had, you know, Americans who, by and large, I suppose, happened to be of European ancestry, although at that time you had different European groups hating each other, you know, the Italians versus the Irish versus the British, et cetera. And we passed a law, actually. There was a law passed to block the importation of Chinese labor, and it was an attempt – Some people who were supporting it because they were just plain old flat-out racists. Other people were supporting it because they felt that it was a threat against the middle class, and it was an attempt by big business to break the labor unions, which it was.
Can I ask you one more question?
Yeah.
I was wondering, has there ever been a movement in the United States that has progressed solely on a nonviolent platform? Because, I remember during the 60s, you had Martin Luther King, which was a peaceful movement, but on the other side of the coin, there were riots. There were the Black Panthers. And was it truly Martin Luther King, or was it the threat of people burning down their cities that actually forced the hand of government to do something about the equality?
I suspect, frankly, it was more Martin Luther King and over the long term. And if you look back at, the abolition movement was a nonviolent movement, the woman suffrage movement was a nonviolent movement, the abolition movement, for that matter, was a nonviolent movement, and the anti-abolition movement was a nonviolent movement. Most of the movements that have produced meaningful and lasting social change in the United States have been nonviolent. In fact, they have stood up in the face of violence, whether it was the Bonus Army that was marching around the White House, or that was, setting up camp outside the White House during Herbert Hoover's administration, and he brought in the army to go after them, MacArthur. Or whether it was, people trying to get the rights to unionize. I mean, the great Flint sit-down strike of, what year was it, 34, I think? Maybe 37, I forget the year. Facing violence and saying, we will face this, but we are not going to become the violence. And I think that those movements have been the most effective. I think that the Black Panthers and the Weather Underground, the violent faction of it, I think that ultimately, and having been fairly close to that as a teenager, I think that it ultimately did not advance things. I think it slowed things down. And mm-hmm. and I think that true progressive movements are nonviolent and produce positive change that way. And authoritarian movements, like the movement in Russia that pretended to be progressive, that pretended to be a movement of the people, that became the Soviet Union ultimately, that became Stalinist Russia, that was authoritarianism. That was, in the same league as fascism, those violent movements. And violence produces, as its child, violence. Violent movements produce violence. So I would say the lesson of history has always been, by and large, that with the exception of resisting violence on a large scale, like we did with Hitler, that nonviolent movements for social change are the ones that have the greatest success over time. Ron,
well,
thanks.
I guess I'll stay with Democracy for America then.
Yeah, there you go. That's what we need to do. Thanks a lot for the call.
Okay.
Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Bob in Thousand Oaks, California. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tom. I just want to, again, thank you for educating the people and the wonderful work that you do. Got a question regarding, I want to get your opinion on an issue regarding the price of gas. Back earlier this year in Southern California, when gas was above $3.50 a gallon at the pump, the price of a barrel of oil was around $60. Now, today, it's hit $86. And there was a big advertisement in the Times, in the LA Times, by the oil industry that said the price at the pump is pretty much dictated by the price of a barrel of oil. So my question to you is, or my opinion, and I want to get yours, is that the oil industry, if they were to raise the price, commensurate with what the price of a barrel of oil is, and just do the math, we'd be at above $5 a gallon. And that would put tremendous pressure on the oil companies to do something about alternative energy. They don't want to do that at this point, or at any point, really. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't think that there's that much of a connection. I mean, a barrel is, 54 gallons or 45 gallons? I think it's 54 gallons in a barrel of oil. Let's say it's 50 gallons. It's in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
So 50 gallons, $80. That's like, a $1.20 a gallon for the stuff that gasoline is made out of. And so maybe your raw costs are even if it was twice that, $2 a barrel or $2 a gallon, if that is going up, if that barrel is going up 20%, I'm not seeing a 20% increase of the price at the pump. I think that the price at the pump, I mean, we've seen over a 200% increase since Bush came into office, or well over 100% anyway. Price at the pump is a function of the control and manipulation of the marketplace that the refiners have. And you know, they're able to control the supply by the saying that all these guys who are saying that we shouldn't have regulation, they're saying, well, we haven't had a new refinery built in the United States in 27 years. True, but the refineries have gotten bigger. But on the other hand, when they want to cut the supply of gasoline, they will say, oh, let's take this refinery offline. You know, it's just, I believe that the price of gasoline is being manipulated in the United States the same way that the price of energy was in California, and for the same reasons, to control the marketplace and to have political influence. And I think that's why you saw the price of gas go down just before the 2004 elections.
I do too.
Let's help out our friend George, you know. But your point that if the price of oil goes up dramatically, it's going to increase demand for fuel efficiency is absolutely true. I mean, the price of gas in Europe has been over $5 a gallon for the better part of 30 years as a result of taxes. Uh-huh. And as a consequence, the average European uses about 1/7 as much gasoline as the average American. And they demand good public transportation systems. And they demand fuel efficient cars, and they get them. And it works. And so, you know, ultimately the ideal thing would be to have gasoline, the cost of gasoline, reflect the actual cost to society, the $3 or $4 a barrel that we're paying in terms of our defense budget to protect the supply of oil coming into the United States, the 50% that we're importing, the cost of the $2 or $3 a gallon that would reflect the cost of the millions of cancers in the United States that are the result of burning hydrocarbons and all those things. If all of that was built into the cost of a gallon of gasoline, you have gasoline probably at $10 to $12, maybe even $15 a gallon, and that would reflect its real cost. That's its real cost to society. And then you're right, there would be a huge demand for change right across the United States. But that ain't happening any day soon, and it would cause, if it was done very rapidly, it would cause such a terrible dislocation. I mean, it would really wipe out the working poor, and particularly people like, you know, long-haul truckers and things. I mean, it would just whack entire industries. It would have to be done gradually. We need that, which is why we need government to be making these changes rather than the market. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
But I've lived enough. And I've learned to be gentle, and I've learned to be tough. I found only two things that last till the end. One is your heroes, the other's your friends. Your heroes will help you find good in yourself. Your friends won't forsake you for somebody else.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Josephine in Michigan on the line. Hey, Josephine, welcome to the program. Thank you for waiting.
Hello, is this Tom?
Yeah, it is. I am, and you're on the air.
Hello. My name is Joe Capola, and I live in Clinton Township. First of all, let me say I am a former entrepreneur. I went out of business after 20 years because of the economy in Michigan and other things, the Internet amongst them. But I would like to say that entrepreneurs face other problems. When I first went into business 20 years ago, the largest department store in the city and in the state tried to get a manufacturer to stop selling goods to me because I ran an ad in the local newspaper. Fortunately for me, the manufacturer laughed at them and said, "What? How are they going to hurt you?" Right. Another case in point is a friend of mine who has a health food store down the street from me. And Kmart sued him because he used the word Vita in his products. Mm-hmm. He lost and went out of business.
Ouch.
Because of a big chain like Kmart. But
your point being that when these companies get to a certain size, you just can't fight them anymore. And
no,
they
you can't.
Eat up, they chew
they
up and
just,
spit out entrepreneurs.
They can cut you off from manufacturers if they want to. They can do anything they want to.
Yeah.
You don't
yeah.
stand a chance sometimes. But I called because of Al Gore. I think Al Gore is wonderful. I think he's doing a great job. However, I'm afraid if he throws his hat in the ring for the presidency, that both Democrats and Republicans will assail him for taking advantage of his favorable publicity. I think Al Gore is very important where he is and can do more where he is and what he's doing now than he could if he was president.
You know, your position, Josephine, is the same as a number of folks. One who I have a lot of respect for, actually, Mark Green, the president of Air America, was talking about this on Chris Matthews' show the other day, and he was saying exactly the same thing that you just said. And it's a position that I have a lot of respect for. I think that it is true. Al Gore has right now the ability to speak out and the power to speak out with an authority and a ring of authenticity that will largely evaporate if he becomes a candidate.
Right.
And then he's just another politician. And I acknowledge that. That said, though, I think that he has the potential to be a larger than life politician, much like Nelson Mandela. And it's all going to depend on how he plays it. But whether he's actually going to run or not, I don't have any idea. If he's starting to take on these issues simply because he's trying to change the debate in the United States, or he's trying to push the Democrats, what Bill O'Reilly would probably say to the left, what I would say is, you know, in the direction of the Constitution,
right,
in the direction of we the people, that's a fine thing too. I'm all in favor of it. I just wanted to highlight it. I want to make people aware of it. You know, what he's doing over at current.tv, current.com, and these statements that he's making, because I think that they're so important, because he does have this moral authority, and because the mainstream media really very much does not want either Al Gore or, frankly, I think several other people, Dennis Kucinich, John Edwards, they don't want them as president because their business interests may be threatened by these guys. And so, you know, they're not going to be the ones publicizing it. So I felt that it's important that I get the word out. Josephine, thanks
That's
a lot
right.
for the call. You're very articulate, and I appreciate it. Jack in Denver. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Real quickly, the phony fear that something's going to happen to this huge industry of insurance if there's some kind of a universal health care single payer is answered by some recent history. When the whole Social Security program was getting ready to go and was being accepted by most of the people, the insurance industry at that time began to market low-cost supplemental retirement benefit programs to people who never could have had any kind of a retirement program, but who would use this supplement to supplement their Social Security and have something that was at least...
This is in the 1930s.
You bet.
Was this E.F. Stone doing that back then, as I recall?
I'm sorry?
E.F. Stone, the insurance baron?
Yeah, and you know, I grew up in Omaha, and Mutual of Omaha basically began into that, and what happened was that the insurance industry overall made one whopping more amount of money because then people had Social Security that they could supplement. That's what's going to happen with single-payer universal health care. The insurance industry will not only not dry up, it'll go bonkers for people to get supplements on all the special things that they want to do health care-wise. So I just wanted to point that up.
Yeah, makes absolute perfect sense.
I think it's what will happen.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jack.
Okay.
Very well said. Thanks. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Just a quick observation, please. Politics and greed are destroying the middle class in America. But what I'm worried about, and I'm hopeful along with you, that the middle class steps up to the plate and changes the middle class. Changes direction of our country and the way it's going right now. The rich and super rich, they're not going to do anything. They like the things just the way they are. And unfortunately, the poor and the lower income people, they can change it by voting. It's true. But sometimes they feel powerless.
Well, and by and large, they're working so hard that they don't have time to pay attention to what's going on. I mean, that's the big problem. People say, you know, why do people of low income have Bush signs in their front yard? Well, you know, you're working three jobs. You hardly have time to even watch the news, much less do any kind of careful analysis of political positions. Coming up tomorrow, thanks a lot for the call, Gary. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be talking to Peter Phillips from Project Censored to discuss why the U.S. lacks health care in the upcoming Project Censored event. Everything You Know Is Wrong. Ann Valisis is going to be here about her book, Kitchen Literacy. That and your calls and the best of the rest of the news all right here. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.